I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Here are a few morning news headlines. From NPR, GM recalls nearly 718,000 vehicles. Reports of abuse by Border Control, Gaza conflict day 17. From the New York Times, swindlers target kin of migrants. Why do Americans stink at math? And over the last week, there have been daily, even hourly reports about the Malaysian airliner that was shot down and the grisly job of collecting and identifying body parts. Turns out that exposure to lots of bad news can have health consequences. We begin our conversation with Scott Hensley, writer and editor for Shots, that's NPR's health blog. NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard School of Public Health teamed up to produce a recent report titled The Burden of Stress in America. And Scott Hensley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marty.
So how many people did you look at in this report?
It was a nationwide poll involving about 2,500 people. It was conducted mostly in March and early April.
You looked at a variety of factors, including the percentage of people that said that the news was causing them stress. What percentage did you find?
Well, we looked at a lot of factors. I think what we were interested in as reporters and pollsters was this notion that, you know, everybody talks about stress in their lives, but what were the numbers that we could put on it? You know, what are the experiences that lead to stress or contribute to it? And I think one important thing to note is that about half the people we polled said that they had had some major stressful event or experience in the past year. And then we zeroed in on the people who said they'd experienced a great deal of stress in the last month. And it was in that group that had felt a lot of stress in the last month that we asked this question about news exposure. And in that case, about 40% of people said that news contributed to their stress.
And when they talked about news, were they specific about the kinds of news reports that were giving them this stress or making them stressful?
We asked it more generally, so we included what they had watched, what they had listened to, and what they had read. But my colleague John Hamilton did a report for AIR about this aspect of the poll and zeroed in on it. And what he learned was that this sensational kind of news of traumatic events, can have a really big effect on people's feelings and make them stressed out.
And sensational meaning overhyped or sort of delivered at a sort of high pitch?
Well, the drama and especially the repetition of sort of traumatic kinds of news. So he spoke with a researcher who looked at the coverage of the Boston Marathon bombing. And that researcher found that people who looked at 6 or more hours of news coverage a day felt more stress than people who were actually at the site of the bombing. So that was an example where, yes, it's stressful, of course, to have that experience firsthand, but you can get as much stress or more stress by seeing repeated sort of sensationalistic coverage of the event.
I found that absolutely fascinating and very provocative. I'm going to pick that up with our second guest who is listening in. But one wonders whether, if as a observer of news, whether the kind of passivity that someone might have makes them feel more helpless and therefore makes them feel more stressed.
That wouldn't surprise me at all. And I think, you know, there's so much news around us. And as there's competition for people's attention, there is, I think, more sensational coverage of events and more wall-to-wall coverage of events. And it takes a special effort to kind of withdraw from that or to say, you know what, I think that's enough for me. I get what's happening and I'm going to move on to something else. And that taking action and saying, okay, I think I get it, and I don't want to expose myself to more of that, is one of the things that the psychologist who John Hamilton spoke with recommended.
I also noticed that there was a lot of stress that people reported hearing about what government and politicians are doing. That's a different kind of stress, isn't it?
Yeah, it was about 44% versus 40%. Yeah, but I mean, they were neck and neck. You know, those things were right behind juggling schedules of family members and ahead of other things that happen in our lives, like losing our cell phones and misplacing our keys and things like that. So, you know, I think it's we're susceptible to these kinds of inputs, and I'm really eager to hear what the professionals who you're going to have on have to say about it. But I mean, it rings a bell with me. It strikes a chord with me about how my life feels, and I do think, you know, it's great as somebody, you know, that we in the news business and somebody who consumes news, that we have so many options now. But I think there is, like many things, the proper dose. How much of it should we expose ourselves to? And at what point do we say, you know what, let's take a break?
Well, and I think that's also true for the public that wants to stay informed, which is finding that right sort of balance of news. And of course, knowing that tragic stories are often very compelling. And I wonder, too, whether there was a difference whether someone got their news from the radio, whether they got it from TV, whether they got it from print, or even the web. Did you look at that?
In the poll, we didn't. But I think John Hamilton's story did explore that. And one of the researchers he talked to noted, for instance, how the kinds of coverage of wars, for instance, has changed. So back in the Civil War days, you know, the newspapers, which would be the main way that people would have gotten news back then, featured line drawings that would take days to produce and would be, by their nature, somewhat sanitized. Then, with the Korean War and even more during the Vietnam War, we got used to dispatches from the front lines, including graphic photographs and video of the fighting and the casualties from the fighting almost as it was happening. And that almost seems quaint with what's available to us now on the web, on television, and, you know, in magazines and newspapers, too.
Well, indeed, we've got this 24-hour news cycle. It is possible to, you know, to not be involved in the news or be even interested in the news, but it seems it takes, that would take quite an effort not to know what's going on.
It's hard. And, you know, I think about, for instance, some of the coverage that we've had at NPR, and in particular, the Newtown school shootings up in Connecticut. And I did a piece for the web at that time with, you know, advice for parents. What do you do? I have young kids at home. And, you know, we were worried. How do you kind of deal with the questions that a child might come up with in hearing about these events? Because you can't get away from them. Eventually, they will hear about it. So in that case, one of the pieces of advice that came from the experts who I talked to and that I try to put into practice in my own home was, you know, to be honest in answering the questions, but reassuring, and also trying to minimize the exposure. So during that period, we really monitored the television carefully and kept the radio turned down when that stuff came on NPR.
Do you think warnings help? I mean, sometimes there are warnings saying, you know, there are graphic images here. This is a story that someone might find disturbing. Do you think that helps to mitigate some of the stress that people might feel?
I think so. I think it gives people a chance, you know, to say, this is a piece that I don't need to hear or want to hear now. I don't think there's much cost in doing that, and I think that's worth a try. I mean, if part of what we're talking about is managing the exposure to these kinds of images and stories, then when something is especially challenging, then why not give the audience the information they need to make a decision ahead of time? It's imperfect. I don't think you can ever do it exactly right, but I think that's one thing that's worth trying.
We have an email from Amanda. She says, this week's news has left me deeply saddened, and I have to wonder why I continue to listen. Is it about solidarity? Is it voyeuristic, which I think is an interesting question. Have you looked at that, Scott?
Well, I have not, but I think one of the things that my colleague John Hamilton found out was that we are wired in some senses to want to know about this news even when it's bad. There are advantages to knowing about predators. There are advantages to knowing the details about things that might threaten us directly. I think the problem is for us now in our modern lives that we have so many things that we can find out about that aren't really a direct threat to us, but that can still zing in on those pathways and those ways that we think about dealing with the world.
You did find, this is looking across this survey, that there's a pretty high level of stress. There are health implications for these high levels of stress in the United States. You think there are certain people who are at risk for feeling vulnerable or anxious or upset when they hear all this bad news?
I think so. You know, once you're in this stressful state, it doesn't take much more information to exacerbate it. And we found out, for instance, that people who are in bad health have more stress, and there's kind of a feedback loop, you know, that you know, if you're stressed and then you feel bad, then things can get worse for you. So I think it is there is a cycle where the things can get worse, yes.
I have NPR on in my office, you know, no surprise there. And I have been listening, as everyone has, that has been listening to NPR about all the coverage of the Malaysian airline that was shot down. And I sort of had to wake myself up in the last couple of days to realize that what I'm hearing about are reports of body parts in fields being collected, put in trains, you know, trains sent that back to the Netherlands. I mean, it's absolutely horrifying, and yet it's you know, it's the background in my office.
Yeah, it is, and I the only thing that I can try and do in my own life and actually in my professional life is try and give people a mix of information. So there are these events of the day which are horrifying, but they're real, and we want to know about them. But in my own news diet and in the things that I try to do in my job here at NPR, we want to give people the hard truths, but we also want to give them things that are interesting, curious, sometimes just fun. So I think in at least the NPR defense, we try and give people a mix of information from the most searing and important news of the day, and then also give people arts coverage, give people things that will help them manage their lives in a positive way. So to me, like eating, I want a little bit of everything.
Well, and as you mentioned earlier, we're about a minute before we have to say goodbye, the idea also of being able to do something. We oftentimes, when we have shows about crises around the world, we'll get someone who calls in and say, what should I do? You know, how can I help? And I think, you know, sometimes there are things people can do, and sometimes, frankly, there aren't. But is that, do you think, helpful, Scott?
I think in my own experience, the worst kind of stress is when you feel kind of trapped and helpless. And if there's something you can do to take action, whether it's to make a contribution or feel like you can reach out and help some of the people who are directly involved, I mean, that helps me. And I feel like there are ways in this interconnected world that we can reach out and try to do things. That's one of the plus sides, I would say, of this immersion that we have in news events.
Scott Hensley, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
He's writer and editor for Shots. That's NPR's health blog, and NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard School of Public Health teamed up to produce a report recently titled The Burden of Stress in America. And part of that report was the stress of being exposed to all the bad news that's out there. We're going to take a very short break, and then we have Frank Farley waiting in the wings, and we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times, looking for what constitutes a healthy media diet. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Open Sky Energy, a solar energy company, supports WHYY. Open Sky Energy helps homeowners and businesses explore whether solar is the right investment in a relaxed and informative way. More at openskyenergy.net.
Where you go to know, it's not just a catchphrase we throw out there because it's cute and it kind of rhymes. It's a statement of who we are and what we do at WHYY. Keeping you informed all day long wherever you are, at home, in the car, at the office, WHYY is there, on the radio, live online, or via podcast. The news you trust with the variety and depth you deserve from our award-winning journalists. WHYY, anywhere you go, where you go to know.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Robert McDonald is the president's choice to head the scandal-ridden Department of Veterans Affairs.
I will put the veteran at the center of everything that we do.
Is that good enough for vets? We'll speak to Paul Rykoff, head of one of the nation's largest veterans organizations, next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Holman Cadillac proudly supports WHYY. During Holman Cadillac Summer's Best event, over 200 of the season's collection of new and pre-owned Cadillacs are available for a test drive. More at Holman Cadillac on Route 73 in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and online at HolmanCadillac.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Today we're talking about the stresses of being a news user and suggestions for a healthy media diet. And joining us now is Frank Farley. He's a professor of psychological, organizational, and leadership studies at Temple University, also a former president of the American Psychological Association. Frank Farley, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Happy to be here, Marty.
What is stress?
Well, we think of two broad categories of stress. Acute stress, something that happened right, you know, sort of in front of your face, if you will, in the immediate moment, versus chronic, things that just sort of build up over time and you're having trouble coping with them and dealing with them. So those are the two broad categories. And then there's the sort of the symptoms, the physical symptoms and the psychological symptoms. And so some of the physical symptoms are things like headache, stiff neck, back pain, fast heartbeat, fast breathing, sweating, sweaty palms. All of those things may be possibly an index that you're suffering stress at that time. And then there's the psychological fallout of stress, if you will, or the symptoms. And there can be health consequences, emotional problems, relationship issues, major life changes. All of these can lead to the psychological side of stress, and you may feel cranky, can't deal with even small problems. You're frustrated. You lose your temper more often. You yell at others for no apparent reason. You find it hard to focus on tasks. You're jumpy. You may be tired all the time. You worry too much about small, unimportant
things. I'm feeling stressed just hearing the definition of stress. Do you think, though, there is such a thing as news-induced stress?
I think so, sure. And it sort of showed up somewhat on the NPR, right, on that whole analysis. But, you know, we're a media-saturated people today. For example, the young generation, and I think this came through in the NPR survey, by the way, the young, you know, the millennials, they don't just consume the media, they live there. They live there. And so there's almost no exit for them because they're so totally habitually engaged with the media. I worry most about them and how it plays out for them. And one of the interesting things in the NPR survey was, firstly, and this has been confirmed, by the way, by the American Psychological Annual Stress Survey, which is that millennials are the most stressed out of any age group. And one of the key things they're stressed out about is too many responsibilities. It's almost a multitasking phenomenon. They, you know, they're engaged in so many things. And, of course, a lot of it is media mediated. And so you know, they're stressed out by just too much, almost a piling on of things. And I think the media is one big contributor to that.
Well, and as Scott was saying, and I think you and I were talking about this before, it's like we want to know and then you don't want to know. I mean, there is a kind of ambivalence about staying involved in the news and wanting to, and I don't think just journalists, I think just people that want to be informed. So you want to know things, and then sometimes when you know them, you don't want to know them.
We call it an approach avoidance.
There you
conflict.
Go. I knew there was a name for it.
And yes. And so in an information age where the coin of the realm in just about every area is information, it's knowledge, and we're in a knowledge economy, you got to be there, right, and you got to know. And yet, it can really get to you, you know. And so, we have this approach avoidance conflict. It's interesting that some of the least stress of any age group is the seniors. You know, they're sort of beyond all that. They can probably take the news or not take the news or worry about something or not, but they're sort of beyond a lot of the challenges of the earlier phases of our lives. But again, I worry most about the millennials. And yes, the media is inescapable, basically. It's very hard to turn it off. I just spent several weeks with very low media consumption.
You were out in the woods, practically.
I was out almost in the woods. And you know, I kind of really wanted to get back into it. I wanted to find out what have I missed, what's going on.
Yeah.
And, of course, as soon as I got back into it, there it was, one tragedy after another, one horror story after another, the piling on of endlessly bad news. If it bleeds, it always leads.
Well, and I noticed, too, and it's pretty obvious, there are screens everywhere. I mean, you just go to the local subway shop or the local deli. There's a screen on there. Chances are it's on a news program. And there's the crawl. There are the images. There's the news.
Yes, absolutely. And it's probably something that needs to be looked at more closely by educators. So sort of media literacy and how to deal with the media for your own mental health reasons. And we don't get into that really in schooling or in education or much in family life either. And also we need more research beyond, you know, these surveys that we're talking about on connecting media consumption and media use to mental health issues. We need more research on that.
And is part of it because we are kind of passive users of this information? I mean, if we could fix the problems, obviously we would try to do it. But oftentimes it feels like these problems are overwhelming. The migration crisis on the Texas-Mexico border, what's been happening in Gaza and Israel, this, you know, horrible shooting down of this Malaysian airliner. What are we supposed to do about that?
Indeed. And do we have any buttons we can press? Do we have any influence? Consider the days and months after Sandy Hook, one of the most awful massacres in American schooling history. And everyone was outraged about it, and we must do something about it. And actually, what has happened? Very, very little. And, you know, that worries me too. Because aren't we a nation that historically was a take charge, make a difference, we all could have an impact? And here, one of the most awful tragedies, and there have been, by the way, 74 school shootings since Sandy Hook. And, you know, it's just business as usual, and we haven't been able to impact it. That's bad. That's bad for this country.
Does it also explain, going back to the NPR survey, that hearing about what the government and politicians are doing is very stressful for people because they want them to do something, but it doesn't get done?
It should be stressful for us, too. This should be the kind of stress that could be argued to be positive stress. That is, it motivates you to do something about it, to change the situation. And we should be, that's the kind of stress that we can, I guess, use in
good
a positive.
Stress,
good
then.
Stress, yes.
Well, we are talking about the stress of being a news user or news junkie. And Frank Farley, our guest, he's a professor of psychological, organizational, and leadership studies at Temple University. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY. Radio Times. We have a comment from Lewis from King of Prussia. Over the past 2 weeks, he felt like he was heading toward a tipping point because of all the bad news. It has made him feel depressed. And it seems to me, I mean, if you really care about children on the border, people being killed in Israel and Gaza, and obviously this these dead bodies all over parts of Ukraine, you know, how can you not feel depressed?
Yes. I mean, it is depressing. And, you know, when our most innocent are being slaughtered, when they're being, you know, our children are being shot out of the skies and in airplane and so on, you know, I would be shocked if good people wouldn't get depressed about it or upset by it. Hopefully we'll get motivated by it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, we want to turn this stress around, as I just mentioned, into a positive force, you know. And some people can legitimately get burned out on it, of course, and it's hard for them to then get motivated to do anything. You know, empathy sort of breaks down into two broad categories generally. There's cognitive empathy.
Right.
I feel your pain. I feel the tragedy that you've experienced. Emotional empathy is much more difficult. Cognitive empathy is where you understand.
You can explain it, right?
You can explain it and say, oh, that's a terrible thing. Emotional empathy is where you shed a tear, where you feel the tragedy. And, you know, it's we can get burned out on that. You know, we just don't have enough tears. We don't have any tears left. And that's the point at which we simply have to get motivated to change the situation, you know, with the politicians, as you just mentioned. And so coming back again to taking stress and turning it, reframing it, and using it as a motivator to change.
Let me get, looks like Louise from Phoenixville to join our conversation. And Louise, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hey,
thank you.
You're welcome.
I wanted to contribute two thoughts regarding this. I'm currently doing a research project on people I'm calling media resistors, people who are unplugging from media for all kinds of reasons. And some of those people are unplugging from news. And a lot of the reasons I'm hearing relate to what your guest is saying about stress. One thing that I want to share with you is that some good news is that people who reduce their news consumption do feel some alleviation of their anxiety. The other is that in my field, in communication studies, there's long been an assumption that we need to consume news to be good citizens, to be responsible voters, to be well-educated. And what I'm finding is that people who limit their news consumption are still good citizens. They do still actively engage in their local communities in all kinds of ways, and they aren't ignorant about events of the day. They just know when to say it's too much.
Well, Louise, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Frank Farley a chance to respond. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. We all need a balanced life, you know. And time is like a zero-sum game, you know. If you spend more time over here on A, you can't spend that much time on B or on C. And the problem with media consumption can be that you're spending too much time on it and other things are being ignored that are very important in your life. And so it can lead to significant psychological issues. So the balanced life, it's a life to be sought.
Louise, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me ask you something. I'm a big fan of Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, as many people are. And I find when I watch their shows generally a day late that it is a stress reliever for me. In certain ways, I feel like I'm not alone in the world. I understand what they're saying. They skewer people in power. They skewer liars and hypocrites in a way that's very entertaining. And I wonder, it's almost like the court jester in a way, whether that is a stress reliever.
Oh, absolutely. They're sort of taking the things that stress us all out and laughing at it.
Exactly.
And what a great solution that is. That's that positive solution to stressful events.
Humor, sarcasm, satire, all of that?
Of course. Poke fun.
Poke fun. Let me see what Ed from Wilmington has to say. Ed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I have a public relations business, so from time to time I'll get stories on the local news. And so that leads me to pay close attention, you know, anxious to see my story.
Sure.
And I'm just so taken aback by how horrendous most of the information is that they're giving. And I think to myself, if anybody is fully paying attention to this, they'd, you know, pull down their shades and lock their doors and never leave the house.
The fact that there's so much bad news, you're saying, are people really just taking this in or not?
Yeah, it occurs to me that maybe they think, you know, a lot of people are making dinner or whatever while it's on. But if anybody out there is really paying attention, it's the fires, the murders, it's terrible.
It is terrible. Well, let me give Frank Farley a chance to respond.
Well, you know, we want to be an informed citizenry, but maybe there are some things we don't want to be over-informed about. You know, one of the things that worried me back in 9/11 was the constant replaying of the horrific picture of the Trade Tower coming down and
yes.
So on and so forth. And I was asked in those days a lot about, you know, what about kids and what about exposure and so on and so forth. And you simply have to control it. And it's under our, you know, basically the media is under our control. In my view, you can turn it off, you can change dials, you can go read a book, you can go play with the kids, you can do other constructive things in one's life. And so it is really, there is what we would call self-efficacy where media is concerned. You can get control over it. You know, and I think that's an important survival skill for the 21st century.
Let me read a couple of comments we got on our Facebook page. One from Ken: I'm cutting back on WHYY NPR because of their obsession with wars and conflicts. Another one saying, I want to be aware of what's going on in the world, but it's so dreadful. Thanks for doing the show. I really needed it. Again, the sort of, I mean, for some people, I think it's like, I'm done. I don't want to hear it. For some, they're in this ambivalence, this approach avoidance that you talked about earlier.
But balance, right. You know, the balanced life. This is, we do need to have an informed citizenry. We do need to try to change the country in ways that we feel are would be positive and would be better, so, and that requires knowledge and understanding. But on the other hand, we have to have a personal life, we have to have a family life, we have to have a life beyond what Murrow used to call that vast moronic eye in reference to television and I guess all media.
Is a physical, thinking about stress broadly speaking, is being physical, doing something physical, is that helpful in reducing stress?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. There are lots of things that a person can do. Let me just run through a few things. So lifestyle change is important. By the way, things like diet and sleep. One of the findings of the NPR survey was that when people were asked, how do you deal with stress, they were given some of the wrong answers, basically, for health reasons. They were sleeping less, weren't trying to control their sleep life. They were exercising less. Those are both exactly the wrong answer.
Interesting.
Yes. You want to exercise, keep your exercise regime or exercise more, get the sleep that you need, have a controlled and good diet. Don't mess around with those kinds of things. Don't make big decisions when you're stressed out. You know, don't suddenly say, and blow off and do some crazy thing. So I mentioned exercise. Let your feelings out is another thing. Focus on something you enjoy, you know. Accentuate the positive, fun things in your life that you really enjoy. That's the Stuart Colbert model, I think. Yes, laugh at it. Learn ways to relax, things like meditation, mindfulness, things like that will help. Focus on the present. That's the mindfulness idea. Laugh a lot, if you can. Try. Share. Nothing like sharing with others.
How you're feeling.
Yes, and how stressed out you are. Time management. You know, it's not that complicated, but some people just have difficulty managing their personal time.
And get kind of overwhelmed, I guess, if they feel like they're not in control of their time.
Yes, absolutely. And it gets away from you. And, you know, they begin procrastinating, and suddenly everything starts piling up. And again, the number one source of stress in the NPR survey was too many responsibilities. Mm. That's the piling on, the piling up, the overload, and it just gets out of your control.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about news and stress. And again, our guest is Frank Farley, professor of psychological, organizational, and leadership studies at Temple University, former president of the American Psychological Association. And we have another guest waiting in the wings, Jerry Weiss-Corbley. She's editor and publisher of the Good News Network. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Time. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Rutgers Camden MBA allows for specializations in critical areas of business and is designed to meet the individual needs of ambitious students and working professionals. Classes are held during the day, weekday evenings, and on Saturdays, and scholarships are available for qualified applicants. Their next MBA information session is today from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at the Cherry Hill Public Library on Kings Highway in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. To RSVP, mba@camden.rutgers.edu or 856-225-6452.
When the militant Islamist group ISIS took over the city of Mosul in Iraq, it issued an edict telling all Christians to leave or face death. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about human rights violations and atrocities committed by ISIS and the Iraqi government with Letta Taylor of the group Human Rights Watch. She spent time in Iraq between mid-May and early July. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
An abundance of risk and a scarcity of options.
Hamas run the risk of actually losing the whole game, even though Israel would pay a very high price in terms of international condemnation.
Former Special Mideast Envoy Martin Indyk looking for ways forward in the Arab-Israeli conflict. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Here's some headlines from the Good News Network. Diner leaves $1,000 tip. Waiter shares it with entire staff. Why people in Louisiana are so happy, and how you can be too. For every bottle, this recycling machine dispenses dog food for strays. And joining us now is Jerry Weiss-Corbley, editor and publisher of the Good News Network, and that's a clearinghouse for gathering and disseminating positive news stories. And Jerry, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. I'm a big stress reliever, I think, for a lot of people.
And I noticed the stress story that we've been talking about from NPR is something that you also put on your site. So what is the goal of the Good News Network?
Well, I used to be in the news business, and I thought, why isn't there any good news being reported? But especially when I had kids, I thought I had NPR on every day in the kitchen. And I remember there was a Bosnian war going on at the time, and they had graphic descriptions of people being raped. And I looked over at my six-year-old on the kitchen table and said, when does he start, you know, absorbing this? So that was the tipping point for me, and I started the Good News Network the next year in 1997. And I believe that if the world is going to give us this kind of news and we're going to be bombarded with it, you need a daily dose of some good news. And I have good news from business circles, from around the world, health, business, earth, all different topics, because we need to be reminded that there are solutions being implemented, that there are really great things happening, and there are people doing really good things, even next door and in our own country.
But are you also saying that the media fails to report on some of these good news stories, the kind of if it leads, it bleeds, that that's the mantra of too many news organizations?
Right, I do. Thomas Jefferson said the job of a journalist was to show how life really is, the society really is. And I think if you are only looking at the bad stuff, you don't really get a good picture of what's happening. And it's easier, I know from being in journalism, it's easier to do a story about an event, a bombing, a fire, a murder. It's so simple. They can do them in their sleeps. But it's harder to do a story about a positive trend or a company that's you know, improving things in certain areas. It's a lot more work. So I would say that it's somewhat lazy, but on the other hand, I don't advocate that people turn off the news. I get my daily news headlines. But today, I mean, it's getting really bad. I think my traffic is spiking about now because it's with all these events in the world and them being repeated hour after hour after hour, it's really getting bad out there.
Well, it's one of the reasons we wanted to do the show because, frankly, all the bad news and tragic news in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Let me get Frank Farley in on the conversation. And Jerry said something about sort of stories that get repeated over and over and over again. Does that add to the kind of stress, upset element for a someone who's a news user?
Oh, sure. So you have a potentially stressful event that would realistically stress out just about anybody, you know, the MH17 shooting down, for example. But then it gets repeated and repeated, and so the stress is sort of, to use an old Freudian term, redintegrated. It gets over and over and over again, and it kind of accumulates, you know, and what's the exit from that? And then it becomes difficult for you to turn it off because what if there's just one more piece of information that's going to solve, you know, who actually shot it down and when and where and you know, was Russia involved with Putin, on and on and on.
Right.
And you know, we're such information-consuming animals that it's very hard to stop this thing.
Well, Jerry, going back to, and even going back to a completely different issue, for instance, in this country, the crime rate, even the murder rate, has gone down precipitously. But I think for people who don't know that fact and just watch or get their news, you would think we're in the middle of a, you know, of a crime wave.
Exactly. It started in the 1990s, and during that decade, while homicide rates plummeted by 42%, television news coverage of murders surged more than 700%. That's a fact I say a lot. It was the Center for Public for Media and Public Affairs.
Right.
Yeah. And so people think it's getting worse. And every year the crime is going down. Even during the recession, all the crime across the board, it just is dropping in North America, in Europe. It's crazy, and people still think there's more crime. On my Facebook page, people always comment about, today, you know, there's no good news today. Well, there really is. You just need to make an effort and look to the positive, and that's why I provided my network at goodnewsnetwork.org so people can see every day some good news.
Frank, you wanted to add something.
Well, crime in general has been showing some decline, but mass murders and serial murders are not. And those are the ones that attract the attention because they're so horrific, like school children. I mentioned that since Sandy Hook there have been 74 school shootings. Those are our most innocent, you know, who can't defend themselves. And so those particular types of crimes are so unusual and stand out. It's like shooting down a plane with, you know, 300 people on board. That just stands out in the flow of our daily life. And it's got salience that other things don't have. And so the serial killings and the mass murders still remain at very high levels historically.
Let me get a caller in. We've got Janet from, looks like, Newtown Square. And Janet is joining us on Radio Times. Go ahead, Janet. You're on the air.
Hi
there.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Listening to your speakers, I was a graduate student, 30 years ago when at Annenberg School of Communications at Penn when George Gerbner was dean.
Oh, sure.
And his focus was very much in this area. He developed what was called the mean world syndrome, if you're familiar with that, where I'd like to know if that's still in play here because those studies and research really spoke, you know, came up with an answer that said, all this bad news, yeah, sure, it's stressful, but what it really does is it makes people afraid. And if you make people afraid, they're going to be more likely to give up their freedoms. Freedom, you know, in exchange for police or military protection. That's a very dark road to go down, but that is an outcome that they found from this type of constant scary news. I'm wondering if your speakers are familiar with that.
Janet, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. So, Jerry, let me give you a chance to respond to that, the mean world syndrome. Does that make sense to you?
Except that I don't believe the media organizations are conspiring to do this for money or anything. As I said, I think it's pure laziness. I think it's easy to do these stories, and that's why they do them. It's easy to put on fires and murders and this and that, but you really have to ask yourself, is this really news? Because I know people are getting murdered. I know there are fires. I know there are train crashes, but is this really news? Tell me something I don't know. So tell me something about the world that's salient in my life and you know, that can help me see the world as it is now, not only the bad things. I don't think we were designed as humans to be our nervous systems, certainly, to be able to take in the worst horrific event every single day from the whole world and then given to us in a dose at dinner time.
I hear you. Janet, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Jerry Weiss-Corbly, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
And she's the editor-publisher of the Good News Network. Frank Farley staying with us for the rest of the hour. And again, the calls have exploded, which is good, and I do want to get back to the callers. But let me pick up on what Janet was saying about the mean world syndrome. She says maybe it's not stress, but maybe it's having a perspective on the world that it's a dangerous place. And in certain places, it is a dangerous place. There's no question about it. But maybe it may be a more dangerous and scary place than it actually really is.
Oh, I think there's some truth to that, too. You know, the overwhelming majority of us lead our lives without, you know, a whole lot of violence, et cetera. But it's so easy to lose perspective. However, in regard to the sort of mean world idea,
yes,
you know, many dictators have arisen by creating fear of the other. Hitler, you know, created fear of non-Aryan people, of the Jews, for example, fear of other countries, etc. And this is an old story. Mussolini arose in Italy by, you know, his famous line was he would make the trains run on time, you know, because everything was falling apart. The economy was a disaster. And, you know, reactions to the economy is a big fear. In the NPR survey that we were talking about, it was in the top three.
Yeah.
And so Mussolini pulled that together, and the economy was falling apart. And he said, give me the power and I'll make it right. And so fear and uncertainty, you know, play into the hands and have played into the hands of so many dictators. So there's something there.
Let me get, looks like Keith from Phoenixville to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Keith. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for doing this show.
You're
welcome.
This
is a fantastic topic.
Thank you.
All of us. I'm a retired airline pilot. At the time of 9/11, I was actively flying.
Wow.
And when we heard about the event, which we didn't know the details of, and went home, my wife started watching TV immediately. I made a conscious decision to not watch that, not see it happen. And I think it was very beneficial for me. Since then, I've inadvertently seen it, and I'm glad I didn't look at it over and over and over again.
But that was a conscious decision, Keith, on your part, maybe in part because you are or were a pilot, so maybe sort of identifying with that horrible, horrible thing that happened that day?
That's right, because I've flown over 10 million miles, and nothing like that has ever happened to me or anybody on board our airplane. So I guess I just didn't want to contaminate my view of the world. Additionally, I'd like to say my wife and I did supervise our children's exposure to the news, especially when they were young, and that's another thing that I think was very beneficial for our family and for them.
Well, Keith, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Frank Farley a chance to respond. I mean, interesting thing that he did in response to the horrific news that day on 9/11.
You know, it's almost like it was too close to home for Keith. You know, it was a misuse of his life's work, in a sense, of a decent man, you know, flying people safely for years and years. And it was like it goes to the heart of everything that he stood for. And I can fully understand that. In regard to children, you know, it's going to be increasingly a problem with kids because all of the handheld technologies, how do you control that? You can't. And now, you know, we'll be getting eyeglasses where you can you can track the media full time. It's intruding into our lives in ways that I haven't conceptualized how we're going to control it, honestly. As an educator, how do we deal with young people and some media literacy and control of the media use?
Let me get, looks like Jordan from Dublin to join us. That would be Dublin, PA. Go ahead, Jordan. You're on Radio Times.
On the technology literacy thing, I could not agree more. I think that the potential of the technology we have is really important, but I think that it's being misused. But my question is, what do you think the source of the apathetic attitude that our society, and at least in America, has towards the news is? Why do you think that there's so much news and information, mm-hmm. but our society is choosing to do so little with it.
Well, that's, I mean, I think depending on who you talk to or who you're talking about, some people are obsessed and some people obviously have tuned out. But let me give Frank Farley a chance to respond.
You know, if we're so nearly addicted to the news,
yes.
we don't have time to take a lot of action. And that's the nub of this debate, honestly. And so that gets to the heart of time management with media. And if we're spending all our time consuming it, then what are we doing about it actively? And so we need to redress that imbalance somehow between our time spent consuming media and taking action in our lives to change the world, like with our leaders in Washington, et cetera, who don't, you know, who we want to do things, but we see them all the time in the media and we're frustrated and stressed out, but we're not doing enough about
yeah.
it.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye here, I also wonder about, you know, dueling pundits, which I watch this stuff myself, I'm embarrassed to say. You know, fighting over issues on TV, does that add to the stress?
Oh, totally. For me, it does. It's one of the most tiresome media
it
experiences
is.
I have.
It is.
I can't stand these shows where there are four people all talking at once.
Right.
Shut up, you know? And how what is punditry anyway today? It's you know, the scholarly side, the insightful side of punditry is to some extent gone. I learned so little from pundits. And then one other thing is the constant repetition of what pundits are saying, you know. And I wish a lot of punditry would go away.
I once heard a definition of an expert: that's a fool from another town. Stayed with me. Well, on that note, Frank Farley, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
You're welcome.
And he's a professor of psychological, organizational, and leadership studies at Temple University. We also spoke with Jerry Weiss-Corbley, editor and publisher of the Good News Network. And we began our conversation with Scott Hensley, writer and editor for Shots, and that's NPR's health blog. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. In fact, you can carry on a conversation we started on Facebook on this very topic. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.